Chapter 9. In Curaçao. Harry Palfrey was sitting with Rex Goodhue in a North London pub. Darker's team haven't threatened you too, have they? Goodhue asked. Then he told him about the two trucks. Palfrey lit a cigarette.
No, but Burr's getting a bit close to Roper, he said. I told them that it might happen, but they wouldn't listen to me.
You told them? Repeated Goodhue. Told who?
Darker's people. Flagship people. You have to play on both sides, you know, Rex.
But they've been listening to my phone and know that I've been speaking to you.
He drank his beer quickly.
So what did you tell them? Asked Goodhue.
Palfrey was quiet for a moment. He did not look at Goodhue.
Darker took me for lunch, he said, finally. He wants to know that I'm on his side, so he's asked to read my Operation Limpet documents. I have to give them to him by Wednesday, 5 p.m.
Is that all?
Why shouldn't it be? Palfrey replied.
But Goodhue knew that Palfrey was not telling him everything.
What else did you tell Darker? Goodhue asked.
Palfrey drank some more of his beer. Then he said,
I had to tell him something, Rex. He wanted information. So I told him that I'd looked at the reports about the cartels and I'd noticed something about the Greek man.
You mean you told him about Apostol? Said Goodhue quietly. Palfrey smiled proudly, and for the first time that afternoon he looked relaxed.
Yes, he said to Goodhue's white face. I talked about how he's working with the cartels and then selling them to us. Can you believe it?
As soon as Goodhue left the pub, he phoned Burr and told him about Apostol. Burr put down the telephone and stared at the wall. He now had a terrible problem. If Darker's team told the cartels about Apostol working on both sides, Apostol would be threatened, tortured, and made to talk. He might tell them about Jonathan, and then Jonathan could be in danger. Because of Harry Palfrey, Burr now had to choose between finishing the operation and saving Jonathan.
Roper, in 2 more weeks you'll be caught, he thought. I'll know which of those 6 container ships has the arms, and I'll know the numbers of those containers and the place for the exchange. Jonathan, you're the best source I've ever had, but you're in danger now. If Apostol is tortured, he could talk about you. Everything will be finished. All our hard work gone.
Suddenly, the telephone rang. It was Rob Rook calling from Curaçao. He was the agent who was always closest to Jonathan and knew best what he and Roper were doing.
Roper has just flown in, he said. Jonathan is with him.
How did Jonathan look? Asked Burr quickly.
He looked well. Good suit, expensive leather shoes and suitcase.
Burr looked down at his desk at the maps of the sea. He remembered all the months of work that were behind them.
We're continuing with Operation Limpet, he told Rook.
Burr flew to Miami the next day. On the plane to Curaçao, Jonathan and Roper had sat together like friends, eating warm bread with jam and drinking fresh orange juice. They had talked and laughed a lot. The bright sun came in through the plane's small windows, and both men looked happy. In the seats behind them sat Tabby and Frisky. In Curaçao, Roper's party stayed in a beautiful hotel by the sea, with an outdoor restaurant and two beaches.
"Relax and enjoy yourself," Roper told Jonathan.
So he did. He loved the old town with its pretty old buildings and markets. He loved the Dutch voices and the real people after the ones at Crystal, people who knew nothing about him and what he was doing. Then, one day, he saw Rook sitting in a cafe and reading a newspaper, and it made Jonathan remember with a shock why he was there. That evening, he had a strange phone call in his hotel room. Frisky was reading a magazine in the corner of his room.
"Sorry, I was looking for another Mr. Thomas in room 22, a voice said.
Jonathan knew that it was Rook. A little later, Jonathan called room 22 and Rook answered.
"This is room 319. I have some laundry, please," Jonathan said.
Then he went to the bathroom and took some papers that he had hidden behind the toilet. He covered them with a dirty shirt and put the shirt into a laundry bag. Then he put the bag outside the door of his room. Just before he closed the door, he recognised the woman in the hotel uniform who was coming to get the bag. She was one of Rook's agents. That night, Roper, Jonathan and Langbourne went to dinner.
"There's a new lawyer coming from Caracas," Langbourne told them.
While he was speaking, Jonathan noticed Rook sitting at the table behind them.
"Where is Apo?" asked Roper.
"I don't know, they won't say," replied Langbourne. "But everyone else is ready."
That night, when Jonathan was asleep, the phone rang. It must be Rook, he thought.
"Jonathan," Jed said proudly.
He was silent for a moment, knowing he should not speak to her. Then he said,
"Get off the phone, Jed. Go to sleep."
But he could not put down the phone, and neither could she. Instead, he lay with the telephone next to his ear and listened while she said his name again and again.
"Jonathan. Jonathan. Jonathan."
The next day, Roper, Langbourne and Jonathan had a meeting with Moranti, the new lawyer. Apostol still could not be found. Moranti was tall and thin, and he watched Jonathan with dark, careful eyes. But Jonathan noticed that his hand was always shaking. It shook as he took Jonathan's passport from Langbourne and copied its information. It shook as he gave the passport back to Jonathan and told him where to sign the papers. When Jonathan had signed lots of different documents, the lawyer gave him a large number of bearer bonds with the name of his company, Trade Paths Limited, written on them. Jonathan signed the bonds too. When they were finished, they all shook hands.
"I'll just have that passport back," said Tabby to Jonathan as they walked out of the building.
That night, one of Roper's drivers took Roper, Langbourne and Jonathan away from the town. Tabby and Frisky came too. They went along a long, flat road that had water on one side and huge containers on the other. The driver came to a tall gate and turned the car lights out. Jonathan could see machines and big ships against the night sky. A man walked up to their car.
"1 hour," Langbourne said.
Then he passed an envelope full of money through the open window. The gate opened and they drove forward without lights past row after row of containers.
"Here," said Langbourne to the driver.
They turned right and a ship rose out of the sea in front of them. Then they stopped.
"Mr. Thomas and friends," said Langbourne through the car window to a man with blonde hair. "We've come to look at the machines."
They all got out of the car and followed the man with blonde hair, who had a gun at his side. He opened a large metal door in the ship and smiled at them dangerously. They went down into the hold of the ship. There were hundreds of containers with the names of different countries written on them. The side of one of the containers was opened, and Jonathan saw the machine guns inside it.
"Guns have their own silence," he thought. "The silence of the dead to come."
As Jonathan stared inside the container, Langbourne began to talk excitedly about how the guns worked and how many people they could kill in 1 minute. There were also missiles in the containers, he said, which could bring down small planes and helicopters.
"Do you like it?" asked Roper proudly, turning to Jonathan.
Their faces were very close.
"It's amazing," Jonathan replied. "Different guns in each container, a bit of everything."
Then Langbourne called to him.
"Thomas," he shouted, "come over here. It's signing time."